Most of the tents and buildings fell to the warriors without a sound. Only when the flames shot up, leaping from one length of canvas to the next to spread to the whole encampment, did the horrified howls of the monsters ring out. Trumpets gave the alarm. Drum rolls called them to arms. Goda kept her arm outstretched and fed further magic into her spell in order to be able to maintain it. She was afraid she might not be able to open the gap again if she allowed the first beam to fail.
"May Vrakus be with you," she repeated quietly, "and with my own children, above all things."
Kiras followed close on Boendalen's heels. They ran forward, passing through the gap in the barrier. The undergroundling felt pain for a fleeting moment as they did so.
"Take out the big machines by the walls first, and the tents," Boendalen ordered, telling the archers to prepare their fire arrows.
While the unit moved over to the right, their burning missiles shot in the opposite direction to keep the monsters occupied, extinguishing the flames. Then they confronted their first opponents. Kiras was struck by the ease with which they were able to rampage unopposed. They had caught their foes unawares at their midday meal. Indeed, how could they have possibly guessed that Goda was going to open the barrier? In the course of all the turmoil created by the attack, more fires broke out as cooking stoves were kicked over in the general confusion. Before long, all the machines by the gates had been destroyed. The largest ones now were 300 paces away. From the direction of the gates, impressive numbers of strangely diverse monsters came surging toward the dwarves.
"Archers, fire!"
Boendalen ordered the rest of the company to continue advancing. Arrows skimmed overhead from behind, targeting the monster horde, bringing some of them dead or injured to the ground.
"And now have at them! Down with them all! Over there! Get to the catapult!"
the dwarf shouted as he rammed the sharpened edge of his shield into an opponent's neck. Slicing through leather protection, the metal opened the monster's throat all the way to the spine. The beast went flying, as good as decapitated. The commando troops slashed and bashed their way through the enemy. Kiras, dispatching many opponents herself, had to admire Boendalen's skill, whether in giving orders or fighting. She would appreciate a partner like that at her side, but a sense of tradition made it an unsuitable match. Undergroundlings and dwarves did not mix. Not for long, anyway. They had reached the tall catapult towers. Two-thirds of her group gave covering fire, while the others hacked at the guy ropes, smashed the supports, and inflicted so much damage on the device that there was a loud crash as the construction shuddered and fell.
"Get out of here!"
Boendalen commanded. Like Kiras, he had seen that the enemy was regrouping.
"We'll withdraw back to the gate! We have done well!"
The undergroundling looked at one of the odd poles that stood apparently isolated on the plain, a taut chain leading back from it down the black abyss. It was only a couple of hundred paces away.
"What about that, Boendalen?" Kiras called out. "Can't we get that one too?"
Success had gone to her head.
"We can do it!"
The dwarf looked at the beasts. Behind a furrowed brow, his brain was working furiously. They still had not found out what the masts were for, and there were about 4 dozen of them planted round the entrance to the ravine.
"It's not far," she said enticingly. "Whatever they're for, we can easily get rid of them, and we haven't seen hide nor hair of their magus yet."
Boendalen glanced at his siblings, who both indicated their approval. One of the Ubariu protested, wary of the long distance back to safety. Their retreat could be cut off. Their armor had grown no lighter in all that fighting, and running was getting more difficult now, for all of them.
"Let's attack!"
was Boendalen's decision finally. He charged off.
"Archers, fire to the left and right! Undergroundlings, bring up the rear!"
In this formation, they reached the first of the mysterious metal poles. The foundations, made of solid lumps of cast iron, were almost impossible to dislodge.
"Get the Ubariu to bend the poles back toward the chasm. They are already under tensile stress."
Bowen Darlin gave the command and reconfigured his troops. Kiras was following the action out of the corner of her eye, watching the powerful warriors thronging around the pole, some pushing, the others pulling. The metal creaked and gave way. The huge chain, which had the diameter of a tree trunk, suddenly went slack and dropped to the ground. Two of the Ubariu failed to leap to safety swiftly enough and were crushed to death in their armor, squashed like insects by the heavy links.
"Come on! Let's get the next one!"
Bowen Darlin pointed over to the right. This time the Ubari expressed his objections forcefully.
"Your mother said we were not to cross a line that's over 300 paces behind us now, sir."
His pink eyes were full of reproach.
"And there are over 40 of these masts to be dealt with. We'll never do it."
He pointed to the left, where a wall of beasts was advancing on them. These had shields for protection against arrows and crossbow fire, no comparison with the random rabble they had previously faced. They were still 300 paces away.
"We need to retreat, sir."
Bowen Darlin exchanged glances with Sander and Bandal.
"Keep that lot off our backs," he told them. "We'll bring down another dozen of the masts, and then," he said, looking angrily at the Ubari, "I'll be the one to order the retreat, no one else."
The dwarf Famuli took up position and raised their hands. Their fingers described runes in the air, and their diamond splinters shone out, dazzlingly bright, surrendering the last of their magic to empower the formulae. A dark blue beam shot out from the palm of Sander's hand, forging a path through the attackers from the front of the wave right through to the last man. Everything the beam of light touched was immediately vaporized to a stinking black cloud, with only molten clumps of metal remaining of armor and weapons.
"What do you say to that, brother of mine?"
she said, panting heavily and flashing a challenge with her eyes. Bandal formed a half-globe with his hands, the open side directed toward the beasts. He blew gently through his fingers, and his breath became a tornado to rout the enemy. Half of them were swept off their feet, banners went flying, and even creatures the size of an Ubari were blown about like puppets of straw. Arrows that had not been on their way toward the dwarves were forced back on the ranks of monsters. Bandal lowered his arms, grinning at his sister.
"I think my spell was eminently superior." "It's not a game."
Kiras had been watching them and waved them on to join the others who were charging off toward the next pole.
"Come on, we've got to stick together."
She looked back at the southern gate, which now seemed a very long way off. The undergroundling was shocked to see the white shimmer that had come through now appeared rather pink.
"I think Goda is having trouble holding open the gap."
The Famuli looked at the opening, and thus missed seeing the horde of monsters split in two to reveal a small, statured warrior striding to the front. Kiras took her telescope off her belt to get a closer look. A dwarf in glorious red-gold Vrakasium armor, with deep black Tionium inlay, was stomping toward the apprentice magicians. In his hands he carried two warhammers with silver and gold heads, studded with jewels reflecting the light. He did not look anywhere near as dangerous as Tungdil Goldhand. Perhaps it was the color of his armor plates. His visor was opened, and she felt suddenly nauseous. The dwarf had no lower jaw. Through the focused lenses, she saw the long-heeled injury in all its terrifying detail. A blow must have cost him jawbone and teeth. A healer had simply sewn up the loose flesh and tightened it so that the dwarf could take in food and continue to live, and had left him a narrow slit below the upper jaw through which, presumably, the food could be pushed in. But he would not be able to speak or chew, Kiras thought. Long, black beard hair reached down from his cheeks to his chest. No hair at all grew where the scars were. Some of the nose was missing too. Cartilage had been cut away, and the hole was protected by a silver plate. Two vertical slits allowed air to be taken in. The very appearance, like a skull, would be enough to root any enemy to the spot. The brown eyes burned with hatred and pain.
By all the...
Kiras put her telescope down swiftly as an icy shudder ran through her body.
This must be the master that had been spoken of.
She told the Famuli about this new danger. Bowen Darlin and the troops, not having noticed, being busy with the attempt to demolish the next metal pole.
Let me,
Bandal said.
I'm older than you.
He prepared his magic spell, took out a further diamond splinter, and clasped it determinedly in his hand to make use of its energy. He murmured a banning spell, and a column of grey light the size of a human rose up before them. At the final word of the incantation, it shot off in a straight line toward the dwarf, transforming itself in mid-flight. It broadened out and developed spikes like fingers. It was clear to Kiras that nothing would survive contact with this phenomenon. The dwarf stopped, twirled his weapons, and abruptly laid the hammers crosswise together. A loud bang ensued, and a second column appeared. But this one was as high as one of the catapults. It surged off, spreading in the same way as the first, developing spikes the length of spears. The two shapes sped toward each other between the two armies. Bandal's collapsed with a crash, and the other dwarf's deadly wall of light continued on its path. Bowen Darlin had turned round now and had seen what was happening. He screamed out commands, ordering an immediate retreat. The discipline among his troops was incredible, and no one broke ranks or shouted, but they all raced faster than they had ever run before to leave the battlefield.
By fracas!
Sander cast a green lightning flash against the encroaching wall, but it melted away harmlessly on contact.
It'll have us any second!
Kiras looked at Bowen Darlin, who was gesturing to them. It was impossible to avoid the magic pillar. It was moving too fast. Sander took hold of her remaining 8 diamond splinters and told her brother to do the same.
Quick! A sphere!
She panted, grabbing his hand. Both of them knelt down.
Get down!
Bandal told the undergroundling,
or you'll lose your head!
Kiras threw herself onto the ground behind the siblings. The pillar hummed close. A milky hemisphere had enclosed them, and, at the next moment, the pillar of light crashed into it. One by one, its spikes broke off, and lightning bolts flashed hither and thither. But the three of them were unharmed. Kiras had a sense that every piece of metal near her, even the smallest rivet on her armor, was growing hot, and she felt her whole body being pinched and jabbed. Then, the attack was over.
We've destroyed it,
gasped Sander in relief. The sphere collapsed, and she felt the wind that the wall of light had stirred up gust past her. Dust whirled up, getting between their teeth. The undergroundling turned her head.
No!
She groaned. Before the wave of dirt hid the scene from view, she saw the wall of light heading directly for Bowen Darlin and his troops. Then the dust cloud became too dense for her to see anything more. Bandal and Sander pulled Kiras to her feet and, holding each other's hands so they would not get lost in the grey veil of dust, they stumbled on toward the safety of the southern gate. All of a sudden the wind changed, and they could see looming up through the dirt, less than 10 paces ahead, the form of the unknown dwarf. He was holding his hammers right and left of him, arms spread out, the heads pointing down. Sander screamed when she saw him, clapping her hands to her mouth. Bandal took a deep breath. Kiras, on the other hand, looked past him to where Bowen Darlin's unit had been standing. The men and women had been caught mid-flight by the magic. Their bodies lay scattered on the ground, and Kiras scanned the carpet of limbs and torsos in vain for any signs of movement. She was suffused with guilt. If she had never pointed out the masts to Bowen Darlin, they would all have been safely back in the Evildam fortress by now. The dwarf's head was held low. A black lock of hair fell over his brow and blew about in the light breeze. Without a word from him, black flames emerged from the hammerheads, and he slowly raised his arms. Kiras stepped in front of the siblings and grabbed her sword axe. "Try to get to the gate," she told them. She was more afraid than she had ever been, but was not going to leave Bandal and Sander here alone. "Go on," the undergroundling urged. "You are more useful than I am." Brother and sister raced off, and the dwarf let them pass. His eyes held Kiras in their gaze. His face was expressionless. Or was that an attempt at a smile on his cheeks? Kiras forced saliva down her dry throat. It ran slow as treacle down her gullet. "You'll have to attack if you want me dead," she called to the dwarf, pointing her weapon at him. "You will be..." She spoke no more. The dwarf moved too swiftly for her to be able to follow. He was suddenly right in front of her and struck her in the chest with his burning hammer. Her armor burst into flames, even though it was not made of any flammable material. The second hammer hit her on the back of the head, and she collapsed, swooning. She could hear the crackle of flames at her ear. The metal of her helmet did not seem to care that it could not burn. Flames flickered at the holes made by the hammers. As she fell, she pushed her helmet off and rolled onto her belly to extinguish the fire on her breast. A foot turned her over onto her back, and the terrible face of her enemy was directly above her own. He was staring at her as he raised his hammer again. The black fire around him had died away, but its heat was still overwhelming. He pressed the hammer head against her brow, and the metal ate into her flesh. Kiras gave a scream and lost consciousness. Goda saw the glowing wall of light approach the fleeing figures and forgot all her previous intentions. Three of her children were in mortal danger. If she did nothing, neither she nor Ironheart would ever find forgiveness. She leaped through the gap and let fall the spell that had been holding the opening against the company's return. She hurried forward to protect Bowen Darlin and his troop from the magic forces attacking them. Goda racked her brain to find some incantation she could use against the wall of light. The enemy Magus possessed enormous power. This shimmering wall of spikes was rushing up behind the troops, who turned to face it when Bowen Darlin gave the command. They crouched down behind their shields. The Magus panted. There were still 300 paces to cover before she could reach her eldest son. She had grasped the fact that she would never manage to protect all the warriors from the wall's onslaught. In her left hand, she had 2 dozen splinters of the magic diamond. They would be no help now. "Take them softly to the Eternal Smithy," Goda prayed, weaving a protective spell which she placed only around Bowen Darlin. He disappeared in a flickering cloud. Then the wall of light hit the troop. It was painful for her to witness the deaths of so many fine fighting souls. The spikes pierced shields and armor, bodies and heads, and speared the dead onto the living until they all lay heaped up like sand on a shovel. Finally, the wind fell, and the corpses rolled apart to scatter on the ground, the momentum still driving them.
"Bowen Darlin!"
she screamed, running on. She could see him surrounded by the shimmering. He was standing in front of the pile of slaughtered warriors, unable to understand how he had been spared and the others had not.
"This way!"
called Goda. Between her fingers, the diamond splinters crumbled and were blown away. Thick veils of dust took away her vision. Fearful of a further attack, she put her hand back into her pocket, calculating how many splinters remained. She noted that she was down to half the original stock.
Again, she called her son's name.
"I'm here, Mother!"
he gasped, coming toward her through the fog of swirling dirt. He was holding his arm across mouth and nose and had screwed up his eyes against the dust storm.
"What happened?"
"The Magus has..." As the clouds of dirt thinned out, Goda could see Bandal and Sander with Kyrus standing before a dwarf in reddish gold armor. His back was turned to her as if he had nothing to fear from her. Or had he not seen her? "Is that him?"
Bowen Darlin's glance flew between his siblings and the corpses on the ground.
"Why didn't you save all of us?" he asked,
his voice hoarse. The hammerheads started to emit black fire.
"He's attacking them!"
Goda hastily prepared a spell. Bandal and Sander ran past the unknown figure, while the undergroundling confronted the dwarf in combat. Bowen Darlin wanted to charge off to help her, but Goda restrained him.
"You cannot help her against this enemy. Only my powers can affect anything."
She chose an assault spell that would bombard the dwarf with multiple lightning strikes. But before she had finished speaking the charm, the foe had felled Kyrus with a double blow, finally forcing his hammer onto her face. The undergroundling lay motionless. Goda released the energies. Lightning flashes shot out from the tips of her fingers, aimed at the dwarf, who straightened up, crossed his hammers over each other, and held them up, arms outstretched. Bandal and Sander had now reached their mother and saw what was unfolding. The glowing flashes crossed the distance in zigzag lines, overtaking each other in a race to see which would reach the adversary first. The first lightning bolt hit the hammerhead and discharged its power. Brighter than the flash itself, the symbols on the metal shone out. Then came the next strike. The dwarf was forced back by the impact, his heels dragging great gouges through the dusty ground surface, but he did not go up in smoke or fall. When the last bolt had hit him, he turned his upper body slightly and spread his arms again. It was a pose of consummate superiority. Then he turned away and strode back to his beasts. He left Kyrus lying there. Abruptly, he circled round again. His hammers crossed against the Magus. Two of the armor runes shone out and seemed to be feeding light to a jewel that was placed above his solar plexus. The gem glowed and released an ochre-colored thick beam, for which the weapon heads formed a lateral boundary. The dwarf seemed to be steering it by manipulating the hammers. Giving a deep, dangerous roar, he flew over to Goda and her children. The earth beneath him was scorched black. Goda put her hand back into her pocket and created a hasty counterspell, which crashed into the enemy magic with a crackling, hissing sound, shattering it like porcelain. The heat they were showered with took away their breath and singed beards and eyebrows and rebellious locks of hair. They had to shut their eyes against the blast to prevent them drying out. When they looked up once more, the dwarf had gone. The monsters were waiting 400 paces away at the entrance to the abyss, watching them.
"Go and fetch Kyrus,"
Goda commanded quietly. The Magus had made himself invisible. Bowen Darlin sped off, threw the undergroundling over his shoulder, and returned with her. Then the monsters roared and charged. They reached the barrier in the nick of time, and behind it lay the saving grace of the southern gate. Goda collected the last remnants of concentration and, with extreme difficulty, forced the red screen open for a second time. She was the last of the group to re-enter the fortress, but when the gate closed behind her, she still did not feel safe. The power of the disfigured dwarf had been far greater than she had feared. Bowen Darlin laid Kyrus on a stretcher.
"See what you can do for her mother,"
he asked, as he dampened the girl's face with water. The soldiers around them and up on the battlements sent sympathetic glances to the returnees. One or two were angry,
critical because of the disastrous outcome of the sortie and the death of so many warriors. Bowen Darlin gave a deep sigh. Goda checked the undergroundling's heartbeat. "She'll be all right," she comforted Bowen Darlin and her other two children, both of whom stood at her side, quite distraught. Apart from the burn on her face, she doesn't seem to have sustained serious injury. The Magus did not recognize the symbol that the enemy Magus had imprinted on the undergroundling's forehead. Was it intended as a branding mark of humiliation? Why had he spared her life? Because she had been so stupidly brave? "It's all my fault," said Bowen Darlin to Goda. He sounded more than downcast. "We should have retreated after destroying the catapults. It was only because I insisted on leading the troops to the masts. That's why they all died." He lifted his head. "It was my fault," he called up to the silent soldiers guarding the walls. "Nonsense. This is war, and war kills. It kills humans, dwarves, Ubariu, and undergroundlings." Goda contradicted him. "All of them knew that it was a really dangerous mission. They all volunteered to go with you." Bowen Darlin was past consolation. "I should be lying out there with them." He lowered his voice. "It is only thanks to your art that I am still alive. It wasn't my strong arms or my skills as a commander that saved me. The name of each of the fallen will remind me that I must be a better leader." He was about to go. Goda touched him on the shoulder. "And yet the mission did succeed. The camp has been burned down, and the catapults have been destroyed. They have not sacrificed their lives for nothing. They would not have lost their lives at all if I hadn't given those commands." He left them and walked to his quarters. Sander and Bandal came over and, in long, tearful embraces, thanked her for saving their lives. Goda sent them off to rest. She stepped into the lift to go up to the tower to survey the scene of conflict. She had not lied to them. The mission had won the defenders valuable time and the knowledge that, without outside support, they would never be able to vanquish their opponents, Magus. Her gaze swept over the barrier, now obscured under clouds of smoke. In spite of all their losses, she remained convinced that they had scored a victory over the monsters, albeit a two-edged victory. "We shall have to wait until the summer, Vrakus," she said in prayer. Her hand felt for the diamond fragments and found only four, together with a great deal of dust. The last ones. Chapter 21. Gerdlegard, former queendom of Ran River Stir, former northwestern border. Spring, 6,492nd solar cycle. The air was cool and fresh, but the sun was doing its best to warm the travellers. The tender golden rays shimmered through the canopy of dense foliage above their heads. There was a scent of nature reawakening, and the first flowers were in bloom. They were not riding particularly fast, not wanting to arrive in the Blue Mountains before Eyferton and his Alfar. Tungdil and Ireheart were at the head of the column, then some of the Zadar and Baskalin, and in the middle Slin and Balindar, with the remainder of the Invisibles bringing up the rear.
"Our messages would all have been delivered by now,"
Ireheart blinked in the sunlight.
"I wonder what Goda thinks. What will she say to our successes?"
"It won't make any difference," Tungdil hazarded. "She'll still have her doubts about me, unlike you, and I can't blame her. In her place, I'd be even more suspicious now. The victory's only proved to her how evil I must be." He laughed. "The Alfar and myself, then the Black Squadron and the Zadar as my new allies, a whole collection of bad lads."
This sounded like the old scholar now.
"If you only knew what I was thinking about."
Ireheart hoped that his friend was not able to read his mind. because such thoughts had been exactly what had been going through it. Add to that those black lines on Tungdil's face and the inexplicable changes in his eye. He had to force himself to join in the laughter.
"Yes, it's a troop Nodon would have given his eye teeth for in the old days."
"A very long time ago." Tungdil cast a quick look back over his shoulder. "Everything's going our way, and some things were just handed to us on a silver plate.
I wonder if we'll catch sight of the Firstlings. May Vrakas make sure they find our message quickly."
Ihart relaxed his grip on his pony's reins, and it trotted contentedly along.
"The points are set now, like for the old mountain tunnel trains. I'd be a whole lot happier travelling in one of them, too."
"That would be fine, perfect, if you're good at breathing underwater."
"Elria could hardly have thought up a better way to punish us dwarves, could she? To get all of Weyen's lakes to drain down into our tunnel complex."
Ihart looked ahead to where their road left the woods and led through the meadows.
"We've still not seen a single human, or anything else for that matter."
"Did you hear the stories Radario was telling us about Ran Ribastur?" Tungdil grinned, and, as always at such moments, Ihart felt so happy to be at his side. As it had been in the old, old orbits, the feeling was comforting.
"Magic animals, which the Famuli set upon each other. A spell put on great swaths of the land, and nature drawing the traveller to his doom."
Tungdil tapped his armour for good luck.
"I'm all right, as long as I've got my armour." "Has he ever taken it off, at any time during the whole journey?"
Ihart tried to remember when he had seen Tungdil without his coat of armour. Certainly not during the journey to Lot Ionan.
"But he didn't seem to stink. He didn't complain. He didn't sleep."
Hoofbeats approached, and the fair-haired Ido girl came up to Tungdil's side.
"Excuse me for interrupting, but I must tell you this," she said directly. "I must speak to you, Goldhand."
"Whatever you have to say to me, Ihart can hear too," said the one-eyed dwarf. And Boendil took it as further confirmation that they were dealing with the genuine Tungdil Goldhand. Millennia nodded.
"It's about the Queen. You should know that she has hardly any magic power left."
"Ah, it was all going so nicely till now."
Ihart's eyebrows were raised so high they nearly touched his hairline, but he kept quiet.
"How do you know?"
Tungdil asked.
"She told me so herself."
Millennia put her hand on her sword.
"I had to tell you."
"Why didn't she tell us herself?"
Ihart blurted out.
"What use is it if we think she's on an equal footing with Lot Ionan, only to find, the first time we meet him, that instead of an inferno, we have a miserable little flicker emerging from her fingertips?"
"I don't know. She had hoped to be able to renew her powers in a source in the Red Mountains. But that did not happen."
Millennia's expression was apologetic.
"I would have wished to bring you better news than this."
"Blessed hammers!"
Ihart went on cursing for a while, then growled angrily.
"So what now?"
Tungdil rubbed his short brown beard.
"We'll have to make sure the Maga doesn't use up any of the energy she still has, whether to defend herself or us, until we've got her to Lot Ionan. Then we'll have to find a way to take her to the source, so she can refresh her magic," he said after some thought.
He did not seem particularly concerned that their most important weapon was going to be far less effective than they had assumed.
"We won't tell the others. They should go on believing the Maga is in full possession of her magic faculties. I'll have a word with her when the opportunity arises."
He ordered the company to halt at the edge of the forest.
"It shall remain our secret for now. Leave the others their illusion." "And how are you going to—"
Ihart could not go on, because Tungdil had turned his pony round and was sitting up tall in the saddle.
"Listen to me,"
he called to the group.
We are now in the territory of Ran River Stir, and some of you are aware of the possible dangers that may await us here.
He pointed to Koira.
She will not use her magic here. The Queen is accompanying us to Lot Ionan and is not here to protect us against robbers or mythical beasts. We are dwarves and should be able to defend ourselves.
A muffled roar of approval was heard.
So do not depend on the Queen's magic powers. She will not be employing them, not even if one of us is in mortal danger. On the contrary, we pledge our lives to protect her and get her safely to the Blue Mountains without her using any of her own spells. Be on your guard and report anything you hear.
He lifted Bloodthirster.
Our steel can cope with any danger.
In renewed confirmation, the dwarves and Zadar banged their shields, then dismounted and made camp. Ironheart grinned at his friend. His announcement covered everything nicely.
Clever as ever.
Rodario, who now sported a neat beard and thin moustache and was thus the spitting image of his ancestor, arranged his blanket under the canvas protection from sun or rain. He had chosen a green lavender bush, stable enough to tie the canvas to. When he looked at Queen Koira, he saw she was having difficulties with putting up her tent. He crawled over. "Let me help you, Your Majesty."
"Oh, there's no need for that," she said, smiling gratefully.
"I'd be happy to help."
"I meant there's no need to call me Your Majesty. I thought I'd told you that before. We've been through too much together, and so I should like to grant you this privilege."
Rodario returned the friendly gesture and smoothed out her blanket for her, rolling her extra clothing into a pillow.
"There you are. Your royal bedstead now awaits."
She laughed and lay down, sliding this way and that.
"It's not quite like home comforts, but I'm sure I'll sleep well in this fresh air, though I shall miss the cries of the seagulls."
"Ah, you'll see. We'll patch up the lake bed and fill the bath again, as I used to call your people's realm." He winked. "Not far from our camp, there is a little stream with a waterfall." He slipped off his armor and outer clothing.
"I don't know how you're feeling, but I'm longing for a swim. Or at least to get rid of some of this dirt."
He stretched out his hand to her.
"Would you like to come with me?"
She laughed.
"Are you trying to seduce me?"
"Of course not. I'll keep watch on the riverbank while you bathe, and then you can do the same for me." Koira's laughter subsided, and she appeared uneasy and dejected.
"No, I'd rather stay where I'm safe in the dwarf's protection. You were telling the story about that thing that lies in wait for travellers, and even if I'm not blonde, did Millennia tell you about Zolotov?"
Rodario looked over to the Ido girl, who was arranging her bedding not far away.
"And that there was another kiss, yes. But this time, maybe, she took you by surprise."
Koira could not resist this little dig.
"I know I don't have to be afraid of the Zolotov, but I have a healthy respect for the enchanted creatures and plants in Ran River Stir."
She sat down on her blanket.
"You'd better go on your own, Rodario."
He nodded and looked disappointed. Then he disappeared off through the bushes. Koira sighed with relief. She had not been sure whether she had managed to conceal her own feelings. An actor like him would surely notice when someone was pretending. What Rodario could not know was that she had longed to accompany him, and she would have bathed with him in the water. Koira looked over at Millennia, who was the exact opposite of herself in stature, colouring, and very nature. Yet the two of them shared an obsession with Rodario the Seventh. She was sure of that.
"What can it lead to?"
she asked herself for the 127th time. She lay down and closed her eyes. But sleep was a long time coming. She kept seeing the man in her mind's eye. Eventually, she got up with a sigh and surveyed the camp. All was quiet. Nobody was paying her any attention, so she slipped through the undergrowth, following the sound of water. The splashing turned into a rushing sound, and a fine spray covered the leaves with drops of moisture. Koira peered through the greenery and spotted a small waterfall, not more than 7 paces high, and a pool of water perhaps 8 paces in diameter at the base of a grey rock wall. Creepers overhung the stone, and flowers on the bank quivered incessantly as they were sprinkled with the water droplets. The actor's clothing lay in a heap on the bank, far enough away from the spray to stay dry. With his back to her, Rodario stood naked in the pool in a theatrical pose before the cascade, waving his arms. He walked up and down, showing his profile. His mouth was opening and closing, as though rehearsing for some grand role. Koira had to grin. She allowed her gaze to slip down from his hips, but did not look directly at his manhood. Not that she was uninterested to see what he had to offer in that area, but decency forbade her to be inquisitive. Perhaps the orbit would come when she might see it in different circumstances.
"And? What do you think of him?"
Koira was startled, hearing a woman's voice behind her. Looking over her shoulder, she saw Millennia.
"I was worried."
She sought an excuse.
"Of course you were, my queen. Same as me.
The Zadar that are guarding our camp are certainly not able to protect us properly," she smiled. "If anyone had told me that I would find myself standing next to the ruler of Weyon, watching a naked man bathe in a forest stream, I think I would have slapped their face for the effrontery." She bent one of the branches aside to get a better look. "Take a look at that. He has a very fine physique. Those padded clothes he was wearing hid his real shape." She noticed that Koira was not really watching.
"Don't you find him attractive? I thought you liked proper heroes and well-built men." "I don't want to see everything," she said, avoiding a direct answer.
The Aino girl laughed quietly and looked at the black-haired queen.
"What shall we do? Shall we share him, or do we have to compete for his affections? Or shall we fight over him and be enemies forever? Ida Slane and Weyon can wage war about it.
We could just kill him, of course."
"That would be the simplest solution," Koira sighed.
Millennia's eyes flashed in amusement.
"True enough. But I wouldn't want so drastic a course of action. It's hardly his fault that both of us have fallen for him."
"He could have paid court to just the one of us, instead of both," the Mager objected.
"And if I think about it, you're already at an advantage. You've had 2 kisses.
"The first one didn't count." Millennia put her hand on the Queen's shoulder. "We should not risk our friendship for his sake. You saved my life, and I shall never forget that."
She became serious. "Do you want me to stand back and leave him to you? If you tell me to, I shall respect your wishes." Koira shook her head.
"That would not be fair."
Millennia smiled at her.
"I respect you all the more for that."
She gestured toward the little pool.
"Off you go. Go and help him bathe."
"No!" she exclaimed. "I can't do that."
"That's the only way to find out what he wants and how he feels about you. Don't hesitate. I did for too long."
Millennia gave the Mager a little shove which sent her tumbling out of the bushes. She stumbled through the undergrowth toward the stream before regaining her balance. Before she could hide again, Rodario had seen her. Koira could not hear what he called out. From the bushes, Millennia urged her to go on to the waterfall and then withdrew.
"Well then," the Mager said to herself, and stepped toward the cascade, which sprayed her with a fine mist and wetted her face, her hair, and her clothing.
"I thought I would take you up on your offer,"
she called out, standing in such a way as not to see all of him, or his little Rodario.
"Very nice of you," he said quietly, walking past her and bending over so that she saw his taut buttocks.
She turned swiftly away.
"I'm finished here now. but I'll keep watch for you." He pulled on his long shirt and hid his nakedness. "May I help you undress? You must be used to having assistance, you being a princess and all." "Only from my maid, never from someone I don't know." She indicated he should turn round while she took off her clothes layer by layer, until she got to the gloves. The air was cool, and she was shivering. She stepped quickly into the water, which was surprisingly warm. "You can turn round again now." Rodario sat down on the bank and watched the Mega with an impenetrable smile. "Strange bathing practices," he said, pointing at the gloves. "Why is that?"
There's a spell on them. I never take them off."
"A spell?" He dangled his feet in the water and observed her. "What sort of spell? Are your fingers so ugly that you have to hide them? Or do you have dirt under your fingernails from all the alchemy experiments you do?" She splashed him, taking care to keep her upper body underwater and out of sight. Koira had surprised herself. What did she think he would do? That he might be bold enough to come into the pool to join her? That he would not behave as a man of honor should? How did heroes behave when they weren't campaigning against injustice and oppression?
"You are making fun of me."
"Never." Suddenly his gaze traveled past her to the pool itself. "Do you know the story of the moon pond? Old Bowen Dill told me the tale. He's not much of a connoisseur about elf romances, but he certainly enjoyed the killing sequences in the story. I prefer to concentrate on other parts." He retold the story, and Koira listened spellbound as she swam in the pool. "What do you think? Do you think there may be more passageways like the one in the story?" Again, he was staring at the water.
"Now I understand," she laughed. "You're trying to frighten me."
"No, I'm not. But we are in Ran Ribastur, the Enchanted Land, if you like. It doesn't have to be an alf that comes riding out of the waves, but there could be something lying in wait for you," he said simply, paddling his feet in the water. "Perhaps I should wake it up. It won't have been seen very often by a woman of your beauty." She was going to call out a response, but then she felt a movement by her right foot. She could not hold back the scream. Rodario stopped splashing.
"There's something there!"
"Now you're trying to trick me," he said with a mischievous smile.
"No, I..."
Something thin and long wrapped itself around her right leg, tightening its grip. Koira stared under the water in horror, but could not make anything out. There were too many bubbles. Then she was pulled downwards. She held out her arms to Rodario.
"Pull me out, quick!"
She was frightened now. Rodario could see from her expression that she was not joking. He grabbed her fingers and pulled. He was getting nowhere. He tugged again.
"Wait!"
He got a foothold against the rock. Now he had a strong enough hold to heave the Mega out of the water. At that moment, he had no eyes for her breasts and her slender body. He saw something clinging to her leg that looked like a white tentacle. It let go of its victim, and Koira shot out of the water as Rodario pulled her hard. Rodario fell over backwards, and the Mega landed full length on top of him. She had dark red lines along her leg, but no injuries. She was furious and resentful.
"That was all your fault. You made that thing grab me."
"It was your own idea," he said defensively. "How was I to know the pool would have the power to make your thoughts come true?" In one hand, he held something made of leather.
"You said the land was enchanted. You could have worked it out for yourself."
Koira had talked herself into a fury, even if some of it was put on for his benefit. Because she was naked, she felt she ought to stay where she was, so as not to show him even more of herself, even more than he had already seen.
"What if it comes out?" "But you can detect magic, can't you?"
Koira opened her mouth to give some sharp retort. Then their eyes met and melted. Their bodies exchanged warmth and fanned the inner fires that poets and bards have so often sung about.
Neither was able to resist the surge of passion as their lips touched, and they kissed tenderly. And again. And once more.
"Your glove, my queen," said Rodario, croakily, his feelings getting the better of him.
He held the leather item out to her.
"It came off your arm when I pulled you out of the water."
Without thinking, she snatched for it, and Rodario caught sight of her right forearm. The daze of happiness on his face was wiped away, as if he'd been given a smack in the face. From the elbow down the arm was transparent and glassy in places, while other parts were raw flesh, showing muscles and tendons and veins under a see-through layer of skin.
"Oh, ye gods," he stammered. "What a ghastly—"
Coira sprang up with a sob, grabbed her clothes, and ran off. Iarhart sat next to Tungdil at the campfire, where they were cooking meat, bread, and vegetables on little spits.
"What a shame we've got no more cheese," he said.
"I can still remember the stink of it,"
retorted Tungdil, who had taken off his helmet, gauntlets, and greaves.
"Very well indeed. Trying to forget."
He tasted the meat, which had been hopping through the fields half an hour earlier in the form of a rabbit.
"I prefer this."
Iarhart was giving his ration a more critical inspection. Tungdil finished chewing.
"What's the matter? Doesn't it smell bad enough?"
He turned and twiddled the spit as if looking for something wrong with it.
"Do you think it might have absorbed some of the magic?"
"What magic?"
"How should I know?"
Iarhart snapped.
"If it ate a flower that one of the Fumuli had modified?"
"Are you starting to believe your own fairy tales? Or is this some myth put about by our young Rodario?"
Tungdil went on eating, unconcerned.
"It's just what they're all saying."
He looked around.
"Where's he got to anyway?"
"He'll be wherever Coira's disappeared to."
Tungdil pointed over to the bushes.
"Ah,"
was Ironheart's grinned rather than spoken comment. "Gone for a swim.
Not to have it off. The Zadar are keeping an eye on them, Baskalin tells me. They'll be safe enough from attack."
Iarhart put the piece of roast rabbit down.
"So it's true."
Tungdil sighed.
"What do you mean?
So it's true. Magic."
"No, not magic. By all that's unholy,"
Tungdil said.
"I said attacks. Wild animals are on friendly forest dwellers."
He slammed his hand down on the ground.
"There isn't any magic here. And there aren't any Fumuli here either. Never have been. The land is safe, and the rabbits are especially safe."
"The rabbits weren't safe from us, though, were they?"
Iarhart glanced at the runes on Tungdil's armor and grew deadly serious.
"Those runes, they'd light up, wouldn't they? If the food was going to harm you."
Slowly, very slowly, Tungdil put his food down.
"Yes, they would,"
he grunted in reply. His patience was coming to an end.
"Give me your rabbit, I'll eat it." "Right you are, scholar."
Iarhart handed his meat over.
"But just take a bite."
"What?"
"Take a bite. I just want to see if my rabbit is as safe as yours was."
He pointed to the decorative inlay.
"If it starts to glow, I'll know not to eat the rest."
He folded his arms across his chest.
"Come on, hurry up. I'm hungry."
Tungdil stared at him in exasperation, then burst out laughing.
"That's the kind of thing I really missed on the other side, Iarhart," he gasped.
When he had calmed down,
"there was nobody there like you."
He bit into the meat, and when his runes stayed dark, he handed the food back to his friend.
"I'll be glad to live in peace and quiet somewhere after these next battles," he went on,
retrieving some vegetables from the edge of the fire.
"I only hope I'll be able to adapt."
Iarhart was chomping his way through his meal with renewed appetite.
I managed to. Well, there's always some skirmish or other, out at Evildam, and we'd talk a lot about what battles might occur. But we weren't immersed in war all the time like you were. To live with the possibility is a sight different from actually having to fight day in, day out.
He pointed his meat spit at Slynn and Balindar.
In case you decide you'd rather be fighting, you could go back with the Fithlings. I've heard there's always trouble at the Stone Gate. Now the Cordrian's gone, the first of the smaller monsters will be along soon. With my son? No thanks.
Ironheart coughed and looked at Tungil, who was gnawing at some half-cooked vegetable and putting some spice on it made from dried ratto herbs and salt.
So you know?
Of course.
How?
You talk in your sleep, Ironheart. Tungdil shot him a smile over the top of the parsnip he was eating. And once more the warrior twin realized he was being taken for a ride.
You're taking a piss.
Yep. I just felt like it. Tungdil chucked the empty stick into the fire. I managed to hang on to one eye, so I'm not completely blind. If everyone else can see it, why not me? He's exactly like me. It must be Teon's own work if Balindar is not my flesh and blood. He hasn't said anything to me, so I'll not broach the subject with him. I can understand it. It makes sense for him to reject me.
He leaned back against the tree trunk and took out his flask. It'll be easier for him if he continues to regard the king as his father. However, this particular adventure turns out it'll be better for him if our two names are not mentioned in the same breath.
He opened the flask and drank.
I wish you sounded a bit more confident, my learned leader and high king,
Ironheart muttered. He contemplated the bare bones left in his hands sadly.
There was hardly any meat on one of them. All fiddly little gristly bits. Not like a guggle. I'd give anything for one of them as my main course now.
He looked at his friend.
Well, how does it make you feel, knowing you and Belindis have a son?
Tungdil stared into the fire.
I don't feel anything. For me, he's just one of the dwarves like all the rest, he said dully, his eye unfocused.
Ironheart pulled a baked root out of the fire, shaved off the skin, and added seasoning.
That's really sad, scholar. I love my children. And there's no better feeling, you know. They make you furious at times, but you get to be awfully proud of them as well.
He nodded in Balindar's direction.
He'd be one to be proud of. Looks fantastic, very good soldier, and he'll make a splendid king for the Fithlings one day. Belindis has brought him up well.
Yes, indeed, I would be proud of him, Tungdil repeated. Lost in thought.
I will ensure he gets back unharmed to his mother,
he vowed to the flames, closing his eye.
You take the first watch, Ironheart. Wake me when you get too tired.
Boindil bit into the vegetable, which cracked open in his teeth like a juicy apple.
Before you seek the refuge of sleep, he said, tell me one thing. Who are the unholy ones?
Gods in the land of the Black Abyss. Tungdil did not take the trouble to lift his eyelid.
Oh, that's not a lot to go on. What kind of gods? Cruel gods, Ironheart.
Let me rest.
And go on waiting?
He chucked the empty spit at Tungdil. It did not occur to him until afterwards what a risk he was taking. He screwed his eyes shut, to be on the safe side, and lifted his hand to shield his face. The wooden spit hit the armor and fell to the ground. There were no flashes or any other magic effects. Tungdil did not seem to have noticed. Ironheart was about to say something but thought better of it. The soft voice of the last of his doubters demanded it. Who knows what this knowledge might be good for, it whispered in his ear. Warning him not to betray himself.
Scholar, tell me about these unholy ones. You know I like a good story," he urged his friend.
"The unholy ones,"
Tungdil began in a deep voice,
"are ghostly beings. They show themselves